I play no part in this story myself, but it happened at a time when I was trying to break into television in the early days and concerned a man I had a lot of time for, Raymond Lestrange. Some of my older listeners may remember him as the ace producer of such popular programs as Raymond's Room, Raymond Lestrange Presents, and The Lestrange Follies. Raymond's real name was Ray Trench, and he was the son of a Staffordshire sheet metal worker. He was a dunce at school, and when he was called up in the early days of the war, he looked round for a quiet job in the forces and settled on the entertainment branch. He served without distinction for 4 years and was demobbed into a world not exactly waiting to welcome the international impresario and entrepreneur named Raymond Lestrange, who Ray Trench had invented, christened, and by then firmly believed himself to be. After being involved in a few prior-to-London tours of revues and musical comedies which never came within 100 miles of the metropolitan area, Raymond Lestrange got himself a job at Ali Pali, where, according to the Radio Times, television history was being made. He started out as assistant floor manager on quiz shows and glove puppet productions for kids, and soon became a producer in his own right. Or wrong, as we sometimes say. He decided to specialise in the television spectacular, and indeed was one of the first people to use this term. To come out with that word, spectacular, without a trace of embarrassment when the largest screen in the country was 8x10, required a certain amount of character, not to say fanatical enthusiasm. This was the quality that Raymond had. He started his career as a producer proper by presenting Raymond's Room. The Room was supposed to be a very exclusive nightclub in the heart of London's Mayfair. The viewer saw the entrance through the window of an expensive car. An actor in commissionaire's uniform came towards the camera and the door of the car appeared to open. Then a camera was trundled out onto a red carpet embroidered with the names of the artists taking part in the floor show. Once the camera arrived at the entrance, the commissionaire gave a smart salute and a gate was pulled across the lens, followed by a sort of roller blind arrangement with bricks painted on it. The idea was to give the impression that the viewer was in a lift going to the top of the building. There, another actor, dressed as a head waiter, greeted the lurching camera and conducted it between small tables occupied by extra sipping imitation champagne, and a few celebrities of the Lady Docker type sipping the real thing. The entertainment was provided by international acts assembled to coincide with their appearances at nightclubs and cabarets in London. Raymond's expertise lay in presenting them in an attractive manner and in publicising himself so that his name came to be a guarantee of a certain type of show with a high standard of professionalism. At the end of Raymond's Room, I remember, the illuminated stars in the ceiling dropped one by one, still glowing, onto the cabaret floor. A camera slung precariously from the roof picked out the design made there, presented by Raymond Lestrange. Well, the cost of this egocentric effect was out of all proportion to its value as entertainment. But Raymond's bosses were indulgent with him because of his childlike enthusiasm and willingness to work round the clock. Indeed, so enthusiastic was he that he actually liked staying up all night and sending out for liver sausage sandwiches and draft beer instead of breaking for a proper meal. I think he had a touch of genius. He was tireless. No one ever saw him tired. Twice he got married in those post-war years, and both his wives were really in love with him. But both marriages failed because Raymond was hardly ever at home. And when he was either on the phone or entertaining writers, agents, designers and the rest. He was the classic example of the man who ate, slept, talked, nothing but showbiz morning, noon and night. No woman could have stuck it, and neither of them did. And then he met Elaine Allenbury. Elaine's grandparents were a Russian Tsarist general and a French ballet dancer, and a Kinsale Spanish aristocrat and a Dawson City dance hostess who was half Cherokee. With such a mixture, it would be difficult to guess from whom she inherited her traffic-jamming good looks. Very likely they all contributed something. Anyway, you can take it from me that the result was a genealogical smash hit. She was also very rich. When she met Raymond, she was filling in time before what everyone believed would be a brilliant marriage to a Greek ship owner or Commonwealth Prime Minister by dabbling in public relations. She was employed by a well-known firm to look after their showbiz clients whenever they made TV, radio or police court appearances. She seemed to have everything. It was not easy to see, really, why she fell in love with Raymond in the first place. My theory is, and it is only a theory, that Elaine realised Raymond was deeply in love with his work in a way that few people are deeply in love with anything. And she felt confident in her powers to redirect all this emotional voltage in her own direction. Once Elaine had decided to have him, Raymond's number was up. In a matter of days, he responded with an enthusiasm he normally reserved for cricketing elephants, bicycling bears, and Edith Piaf. The same week that saw the meeting of Elaine and Raymond in the BBC canteen at Alexandra Palace also saw the arrival there of a young graduate who had appeared with some success in a university review and had been signed up by the corporation and attached to Raymond in a sort of apprentice capacity. His name was Brian Price, and he was a bright and eager 22, with a flair for satirising everyone of 23 and over. Preoccupied as he was with his love affair, Raymond didn't have a great deal of time and energy left over for Master Brian. But he did, conscientiously, try to show him the important ropes. For instance, he introduced him to Gavin, the special effects man, without whose cooperation no production could be transmitted successfully. Raymond also introduced useful people in the shape of arrangers who could get anyone through musically and designers who could do the same visually. These vital helpers, nursed and cherished by Raymond, were not much appreciated by the brilliant Brian, who, having read several books on how silent films were produced in the Soviet Union and seen the Busby Berkeley season at the University Film Club, believed that he had something original and uniquely his own to bring to the exciting new medium of telly. Raymond was determined to make this, his third marriage, work. And no doubt aware that he was not getting any younger, he tried hard to reassure Elaine that, unlike his previous loves, she was not a liability that had to be coped with in time stolen from the BBC. At the time, six shows were in preparation. Gala Night in Paris, Gala Night in Venice, and Gala Night in four other capitals. I believe when this idea was first mooted, or conceived, as Raymond always put it, the shows were to be called Raymond Lestrange's Paris, Raymond Lestrange's Venice, etc. But since Raymond was now going to be on his honeymoon when they were scheduled for production, the responsibility was left to young Brian, and they were called Gala Night Inn, etc. Though I believe Brian did actually suggest that they could be called Brian Price's Paris, and so on. This crummy idea was vetoed, but it did a great deal to prejudice people against Brian before he even started work. Raymond proved his matrimonial seriousness by agreeing to a fashionable wedding at St. George's Hanover Square, with a reception at Grosvenor House afterwards. The happy groom also arranged a four-week honeymoon in quiet but very expensive hotels in the Cotswolds, the Lake District, and finally a small pub outside Aylesbury. He really convinced his lovely bride that he was going to leave showbiz behind for the duration of the honeymoon. When the happy couple drove away from Grosvenor House in Raymond's Bentley Continental, the future looked very promising indeed. In all fairness to Raymond, he kept his word. Admittedly, no one knows what he was thinking about as he trudged around the Gloucestershire golf courses and the hills and dales of Westmorland. Naturally, since I was not on the honeymoon with them, this part of my story is largely conjecture. I can only guess at what happened. My theory being that Raymond Lestrange, without the trappings of a successful producer of television spectaculars, started to shed his protective colouring and became, once more, Ray Trench, insignificant son of an insignificant sheet metal worker, duffer at school and a mere army number. I think I mentioned that the last night of the honeymoon was at a small pub outside Aylesbury. Buckinghamshire was at that time a particularly good reception area. And it was also the night that Brian Price was in the control room at Alley Pally for the first time. There was, I would guess, a certain amount of disquiet on Elaine's part when Raymond insisted on watching the box that night in preference to enjoying her own colourful three-dimensional charms. What Raymond's reactions to the show were can only be guessed at. But I know Raymond, and of course I saw the show. Gala Night in Venice, it was called. It should have been Gala Night in Paris, but before he left, Raymond had applied to the booking department for Maurice Chevalier himself. There was a misunderstanding about fees, because he asked so many thousands that the BBC thought he was talking in francs, but it turned out he was talking in pounds, so the deal fell through. Then it was arranged for a well-known impersonator to do an impersonation of Maurice Chevalier, backed by 28 girls wearing straw boaters just in case viewers didn't recognise the impersonation. Then it was discovered that the intricate water arrangements for the following show, Gala Night in Venice, could only be made on the night that Gala Night in Paris was scheduled. Raymond, in similar circumstances, would have had a drink with Gavin, the effects man, and made some sort of compromise arrangements with him. But not Brian. He first of all tried to turn the circumstances to advantage by planning to use the Venetian canals as Paris streets in the Paris in the Rain sequence on the original date, and do Gala Night in Venice without canals at all. But the gondolas were already being built, and anyway the famous Italian tenor who'd been engaged would not agree to appear in a show about Paris, but did agree to the date being changed. The 28 straw boaters which had been purchased were both paid for and returned to the manufacturer. They were paid for because someone at the BBC pointed out that the corporation had a responsibility to the small businessman, and they were returned because someone else at the BBC pointed out that the corporation must not waste the licence payer's money. Rehearsals began. The first casualty was the famous Italian tenor who lost his voice in Vienna singing Rigoletto. A lesser-known Italian tenor was engaged. He only lasted half a day, and then he went down with something he described as English tummy. The next tenor was a completely unknown Italian who turned out to be a baritone, and anyway got lost somewhere between Milan and London, possibly in the customs shed. Finally, an Irish tenor was engaged, and extra fees were agreed when he was told he would have to dress in gondolier costume and propel a gondola. In all fairness to Brian, he inherited a whole heap of trouble from the absent Raymond. For instance, Raymond was addicted to animals in his shows and hired them from a pet dealer named Ramage, who happened to be a founder member of his local migraine club. Long before Raymond even met Elaine, he'd booked four swans from pain-racked Mr. Ramage, and no one thought of cancelling the arrangement. Rehearsals started badly and got rapidly worse. The special effects man, Gavin, was alienated very early on. A grave error, this, because he was very proud of his water. The musical director was bawled out in front of his orchestra and told he had no sense of tempo and was probably tone-deaf as well. Mr. Ramage, with a splitting headache, was left in a dressing room with his four swans until someone remembered him and threatened him with prosecution for cruelty to animals. Someone else told him it was against BBC rules to allow birds in dressing rooms and that he would probably be prosecuted. And a third person, preparing the firework finale, exploded a maroon a few feet from his ear and increased his migraine and unhinged all four swans. The only person on the production who remained unruffled and confident was the Irish tenor Michael O'Hanrahan. After his morning rehearsals, when the musical director had been insulted by Brian, O'Hanrahan had retired to his dressing room and remained there, waiting for his call to do the actual show. With him were no fewer than 24 bottles of his national beverage, which he referred to whimsically as tranquilizers. At 5 o'clock, the unit broke for tea, even though the finale had not been rehearsed. Many of those about to take part in the show must have felt like soldiers about to go over the top against overwhelming odds. So the time for the show approached. Imagine, if you can, Raymond and his lovely bride sitting in the television lounge of the pub in Buckinghamshire waiting for the much-publicised spectacular to begin. For the first time on the honeymoon, Raymond smoked cigarettes and forgot to offer any to Elaine. Together, they watched a particularly dull documentary about the fish canning industry in British Columbia. After 30 boring minutes, the end titles faded and then one word filled the screen. It seemed to be in letters of the Russian alphabet, but the quicker-witted viewers just had time to realise it was the word interlude upside down before the immaculate top half of MacDonald Hobley appeared. Reassuring and apparently quite confident, he announced that the big show of the week was about to begin. Gala night in Venn. He didn't manage to get the last syllable out before his image disappeared and was replaced by the potter's wheel going round and round above a caption which said interlude, this time the right way up. This shaky prelude must have shaken Raymond, and I expect he increased his consumption of cigarettes and very likely sent out for a liver sausage sandwich, always a sign that he was feeling tense. He would know that the uncertainty at Ali Pali was a symptom of something being wrong. Exactly what could not be kept a secret much longer? Suddenly, it happened. The caption was withdrawn. Another interlude, this time fish swimming in a murky tank, and then, after about 2 seconds of that, the opening titles of Gala Night in Venice. We first saw a badly lit replica of the Ponte Rialto with a workman in white overalls hammering nails into one of the supports. The orchestra struck up Carnival in Venice, and the workman, hearing this, looked at the camera and walked straight across the canal through water, which was now seen to be only about an inch deep. Then, believe it or not, we saw another caption, devised and produced by Raymond Lestrange. Raymond, sitting in the pub, he must have flipped. It must have been like a blow in the solar plexus, but worse was to follow. He was to get a right, left of the body and several beautifully timed blows to the chin. To begin with, the water started to gurgle away. It fell below the level necessary to conceal the casters on the gondola. Nevertheless, down what appeared by now to be merely a damp street, on came the gondola, with the Irish tenor aboard and full of what he had described as his tranquilizers. He was tranquilized as a newt. The musical director, by now suffering many of the symptoms of acute shell shock, slowed the orchestra in order to help the tenor. The tenor put on a spurt to help the orchestra. Just as they were all in danger of grinding to a halt, Mr. Ramage, the pet expert with the migraine, released his four swans from their wicker basket, and they flew not towards the water near the bridge, but straight out of camera range and into the middle of the orchestra. The musicians, like everyone else in this country, had been taught from birth that a swan can break a man's arm with its wing, and attempted to escape, many of them sacrificing their expensive instruments to do so. The noise was deafening. Well, it had to be heard to be believed. Looking back on it now, it's amazing that the Irish tenor was able to continue singing, but he did, and thus confirmed the suspicion of all of us except Byron Price that he was a pub singer born and bred. The scene after the Ponte Rialto was supposed to be three jugglers in the Piazza San Marco. This was in a worse state of preparedness than the Ponte Rialto. The three jugglers did well to keep their clubs up in the air at all under the trying circumstances. The church actually started to disintegrate behind them. A lot of water, missing from the previous scene, had flowed across the studio and had soaked into the lath and plaster base. It started to sink, slowly at first, but with gathering speed, like a souffle in a very cold room. After watching about a quarter of an hour of this catastrophic show, which through some departmental blunder bore his name, Raymond jumped into his Bentley and drove like a maniac to Alexandra Palace. I don't know what passed between him and the lovely Elaine. She probably begged him to stay with her. She may have suggested going with him. We don't know. All we do know is that he went alone. We also know from subsequent events that that was the end of the marriage. They were never able to pick up the pieces, as they say in the movies. On his arrival at Alipalli, the show was over, and Raymond found Brian sitting alone in the control room which overlooked the deserted studio, scene of the debacle. What exactly was said again, we don't know. But next morning, at 10 sharp, Raymond was busy rehearsing the next show in the series, Gala Night in Paris. He bought liver sausage sandwiches and draft beer for the entire cast by way of celebration of his return. Ray Trench was dead forever, and Raymond Lestrange was himself again. Elaine appeared later that morning, and the newlyweds were seen together for a few minutes at lunchtime, and that was all. Anyway, Raymond had no time. He worked at tremendous speed, a man inspired. He won the admiration of all concerned, with two notable exceptions. His young wife and Brian Price. They stayed in the background. They stayed in the background together. All through the rehearsals they sat whispering to each other and laughing quietly as though sharing jokes too clever to communicate to anyone else. Everyone on the show must have noticed their self-absorption. I think even Raymond must have noticed it, preoccupied though he was. Well, when production day finally dawned, Raymond enjoyed one of the greatest triumphs of his career. I am here to tell you it was one of the most memorable TV shows ever to come out of dear old Alipalli, a zonking, woofing, copper-bottomed stonewall smasheroo. I remember the finale. Well, shall I ever forget it? 28 girls in straw boaters, purchased and paid for a second time, danced round a replica of the Eiffel Tower, singing "Every Little Breeze Seems to Whisper Louise." They were supported by the rest of the huge cast. Bearded waiters in smocks and wide-brimmed hats, can-can dancers, knockabout monks, whistling apaches, comic waiters, and American tourists with cameras. Nice touch of satire here. Finally, as the music faded, the lights changed, and the 28 girls bowed towards the cameras, and on the crown of each straw hat was a letter of the alphabet picked out in luminous paint. Together, the hats spelt out the magic phrase, "Presented by Raymond Lestrange." It was a triumph. The orchestra burst their guts playing "Sarce Paris." Everyone cheered. Everyone except Brian Price and Elaine. They were in Paris. In Paris and no doubt having a marvellous time. The inevitable divorce followed some months later, and they were married in Mexico City and settled down to a fashionable life in Acapulco. She was loaded, I think I told you. Brian never did a stroke of work again, and was able to stop satirizing the rich because he became one of them. What did Elaine see in him? In a way, it was the same thing that attracted her to Raymond. Brian loved Brian so much that Elaine felt if only that love could be converted to her own person, she would have a lover of Olympian quality. I don't know how it worked out, but to my mind, Brian wasn't good convert material. Raymond still produces the odd nostalgic spectacular, still eats liver sausage sandwiches and drinks draft beer, loves to sit in the BBC Club and reminisce about the old days at Alipalli. Mentions Gala Night in Paris quite frequently. Gala Night in Venice, very seldom.
J. Kingston Platt's Showbiz Handbook was written and performed by Peter Jones. The producer was Pete Atkin.